A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been turning this one over for a while, and I can hear it in the way he frames it. This isn't the tactical question of how to be boring. It's the harder question of whether you can be boring on purpose in one room and still be the person you fought to become in every other room.
Here's what Daniel wrote in. We've covered gray rocking before. The strategy from narcissistic abuse circles, where you make yourself as uninteresting as possible, so a toxic person has nothing to feed on and eventually loses interest. And we've talked about how it's a necessary survival tool for people who've decided no contact isn't an option. Family obligations, shared custody, a workplace, caregiving. Sometimes you have to stay in some kind of relationship with someone who's actively harmful. But Daniel's pointing at something we haven't really sat with. A healthy person pursuing nourishing relationships is open and forthcoming. People who've spent a lifetime dealing with toxic individuals learn the opposite. Self-censorship, guardedness, because they learn for very good reasons that anything they share can be weaponized. So here's the tension. You do the therapy, you do the growth, you learn to trust people again. And then Grey Rocking asks you to temporarily unlearn all of that for one specific relationship. It feels wrong. And it feels scary. Because the fear is that the regression won't stay bounded. That you'll slide back into the guarded version of yourself you worked so hard to leave behind. He's also flagging that this is a point in favor of no contact being the better long-term option, but that in an imperfect world, plenty of people have to maintain low-contact relationships with harmful people. So the question is, how to hold that duality without losing the self you fought to become? And he's asking for advice and tips, preferably grounded in science.
So the question is, how do you wear the mask without becoming the mask? And I think the first thing to say is that the fear he's describing isn't irrational. It's a realistic appraisal of how the brain actually works.
Say more.
Gray rocking is a form of strategic self-silencing. And self-silencing has a research literature going back to the early 90s. Dana Jack's work in 1991, looking at how women in particular suppress their thoughts and feelings in relationships to avoid conflict or maintain connection. And what the research has consistently found since is that chronic self-silencing is linked to depression, anxiety, and a diminished sense of self. Not in a vague spiritual way, measurable clinical outcomes. When you habitually swallow your own voice, your own experience, your own reactions, it corrodes your sense of who you are.
So gray rocking is self-silencing with a tactical purpose.
Right. And that's what makes it different from, say, being polite to a difficult coworker. You're not just filtering, you're deliberately flattening your entire emotional presence. No humor, no opinions, no warmth, no reactivity. You're making yourself into a boring object. And the reason that's psychologically costly is that you're acting in direct contradiction to your values. If you've done the work to become someone who's open and honest, gray rocking asks you to perform the opposite of that. And the research on self-silencing tells us that acting against your own voice, even strategically, has a cost.
I think the part Daniel is circling is the bleed. The fear that it won't stay in the one relationship.
And that's where the neat compartmentalization fantasy falls apart. We like to think we can be one person with a toxic parent, and another person with our partner, and another person at work. And to some degree, we do that. Code switching is real and adaptive. But there's a difference between adaptive code switching and forced self-suppression. The research on contextual authenticity, on multiple selves and well-being, shows that people thrive when they can be authentic across contexts. When you feel like you have to hide core parts of yourself in a significant relationship, well-being drops. And here's the thing about the brain. It doesn't compartmentalize that cleanly. The neural pathways for guardedness don't have a switch labeled only use with mom.
That's the part I think most gray rocking advice misses. It's presented as a technique, like a golf swing. But you're not practicing a motor skill. You're practicing an emotional state. And emotional states generalize.
And this connects to why Daniel's fear of regression isn't some catastrophic thinking. It's a known property of how habits and emotional patterns work. If you spend Sunday afternoon being a gray rock with a narcissistic parent, by Monday morning you might notice you're being shorter with your partner, not because you chose to be, because the guardedness carried over. You practice being closed for 4 hours, and the residue is still there.
The Sunday lunch with the parent, and then Monday being weird with your partner. That's the exact scenario.
And it's the scenario that the Grey Rock guides don't really prepare you for. Annie Wright, who's a therapist who's written one of the better guides on this, makes the point that Grey Rocking can backfire. It can make you feel worse, not better. Because you're acting in ways that contradict your values and your healed self. You're being deliberately cold and unresponsive, and if you're someone who values warmth and connection, that internal conflict is painful. It's a tool with side effects, and the side effects are under discussed.
So the duality itself is the risk, not the toxic person, the strategy.
The strategy asks you to hold two incompatible selves in your head, the open, trusting person you become and the flat, unreactive person you need to be for this one relationship. And the question is whether that's sustainable. And I think the answer is, it depends on what else is in your life.
That's the self-complexity angle, right?
Linville's work from 1987. Self-complexity theory. The idea is that people have multiple self-aspects, roles, relationships, identities, and people with more distinct self-aspects are more resilient to stress. The reason is that if one aspect of your identity is taking damage, the others can hold. If your entire identity is wrapped up in one role and that role gets threatened, you crumble. But if you have many roles, the damage is contained.
So the Grey Rock self is one self-aspect among many, and the question is whether the other self-aspects are strong enough to hold you.
Right. If you're Grey Rocking with a toxic ex during custody exchanges, and that's 1 hour a week, and the rest of your week is full of relationships where you're fully yourself, the cost is real but manageable. But if the Grey Rock relationship is a major part of your life, or if you don't have other contexts where you can be open, then the guarded self starts to dominate, because it's the one you're practicing most.
That's the mechanism for the regression. It's not a sudden collapse. It's a slow tilt. You practice guardedness enough, and it becomes the default.
And here's where the practical advice starts to emerge from the research. The first thing is what I'd call authenticity anchors. You need at least one or two relationships where you can be completely open, not mostly open, completely. Where you can say the thing you're actually thinking, including about the toxic person and the gray rocking. And the research on authenticity and well-being supports this. Having contexts where you can be your full self buffers the cost of having to be guarded elsewhere.
So it's not about balance. It's about counterweight.
A standing Friday dinner with friends where you can be fully yourself after a week of gray rocking with a difficult family member. That dinner isn't just pleasant, it's doing psychological work. It's reminding your nervous system that the guarded self isn't the only self.
And I'd add that the timing matters. If you know you have to gray rock on Sunday, don't schedule nothing for Monday. Schedule the openness. Deliberately plan time with people who get the full you, especially after the gray rock interaction. Don't wait to feel like yourself again. Engineer it.
Because the bleed is most likely in the immediate aftermath. The residue is freshest right after the interaction, so having a planned reset is protective.
What about the internal work? The self-compassion piece?
Neff's work on self-compassion is directly relevant here. The core idea is that acknowledging your own suffering without judgment helps you tolerate difficult emotional states. Gray rocking is painful. You're acting against your values. You're being deliberately cold to someone, even if they've earned it. And the natural response is to either beat yourself up for it or to try to ignore the discomfort. Self-compassion offers a third path. You acknowledge that this is hard, that you're doing it for a reason, and that the discomfort doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. It means you're doing something costly.
Because if you don't acknowledge the cost, it comes out sideways.
Right. You get irritable with your partner. You sleep badly. You start avoiding the toxic person in ways that create more problems. The unacknowledged cost doesn't disappear. It just gets spent somewhere else.
So the self-compassion is almost a containment strategy. You're metabolizing the cost consciously instead of letting it leak.
And there's a practical version of this, what some people call a self-compassion break. After a gray rock interaction, you take a few minutes to just name what happened. I just had to be someone I'm not, for 2 hours, and that was hard, and I'm going to be kind to myself about it. It sounds small, but the research suggests it actually changes how the brain processes the experience. It moves it from a threat response to a manageable difficulty.
The other piece I keep coming back to is the identity framing. Am I a guarded person, or am I a person who's currently being guarded in this one context?
That distinction matters a lot. The research on role-playing and identity suggests that when people can frame a behavior as a temporary role rather than a core identity, they're less likely to internalize it. Actors don't become their characters. They put on the costume, they perform, they take it off. And the costume metaphor is actually useful. Gray rocking is a costume you put on for a specific audience. It's not a skin you're growing into.
But the costume metaphor has a limit, right? Because an actor gets to leave the theater. The gray rocker goes home and has to be a full person again, sometimes within the same hour.
That's the hard part, the transition. And that's where the rituals matter, just deliberate transitions. The drive home from the difficult interaction where you consciously tell yourself, okay, that's done, I'm taking the costume off now. Maybe you call a friend on the drive. Maybe you listen to music that feels like you, something that marks the boundary between the performance and the real self.
I think there's also a role for checking for bleed, actively noticing if you're being guarded with people who haven't earned it, and course-correcting when you catch it.
That's a form of metacognitive monitoring, and it's trainable. You can ask yourself, am I being short with my partner because I'm actually annoyed with my partner, or because I just spent 3 hours gray-rocking with my mother and the residue is still there? And just naming that distinction can break the spell. It reminds you that the guardedness belongs to a specific context, not to your current relationship.
The other thing I'd flag is the time limit. Gray rocking isn't a forever strategy, and if you can't see an endpoint, that's information.
That's the Annie Wright point again. Gray rocking can backfire if it's used too broadly or for too long. The self-silencing research tells us that chronic suppression has cumulative costs, so the question isn't just how do I gray rock well? It's how do I make sure this is temporary and bounded? And if the answer is, I can't see an endpoint, then no contact needs to be revisited. Not because gray rocking is bad, because it's not designed for permanent use.
It's a bridge, not a destination.
And sometimes the bridge is long. Shared custody can mean years of gray rocking. Caregiving for a toxic parent can be indefinite. But even in those cases, there's a difference between knowing the bridge has an end and feeling like you're just walking forever. The knowing matters.
Let me try to pull this together. The research says the duality is costly, but manageable under specific conditions. You need self-complexity, so the gray rock self is a small part of a larger identity. You need authenticity anchors, relationships where the full self gets expressed. You need self-compassion to metabolize the cost consciously. You need the role framing, the costume metaphor, to prevent internalizing the guardedness. And you need to check for bleed and set time limits so the regression doesn't become the new normal.
And I'd add one more. Build the counterweight deliberately. Invest in roles and relationships that have nothing to do with the toxic person, not just as a distraction, but as an identity project. The more substantial your other selves are, the less power the gray rock self has over you.
So the advice isn't how to gray rock better. It's how to gray rock less, and how to make sure the rest of your life is strong enough to hold the cost.
That's the shift. And I think it's the shift Daniel's looking for. He's not asking for a technique. He's asking how to do something painful without being defined by it.
And the honest answer is you can't do it without cost. The cost is real. But you can make the cost manageable. You can make it bounded. You can make it something you do rather than something you are.
There's one more thing I want to put on the table. The misconception that gray rocking is psychologically neutral, that it's just a technique, like using a different tone of voice. And the research on self-silencing says that's wrong. It's not neutral. It's a form of self-suppression, and self-suppression has consequences. So anyone who tells you to just gray rock and not worry about, it's missing the actual mechanism of harm.
It's the difference between holding your breath and learning to breathe underwater. One is a temporary adaptation. The other is a transformation you might not want.
And the transformation you might not want is the guarded self becoming the default self. That's the regression Daniel is afraid of, and it's a legitimate fear. Not because he's weak or because he hasn't healed enough. Because the brain is a pattern-matching machine, and practiced patterns generalize.
So the goal isn't to eliminate the fear. It's to build the structures that make the fear less likely to be realized.
And to be honest about the limits, gray rocking isn't a solution, it's harm reduction. And harm reduction is worth doing, but it's not the same as healing. The healing is in the other relationships, the other contexts, the other selves. The gray rocking is just what you do to survive the one context that can't be healed.
I want to sit with that for a second, because I think that's the reframe that actually helps. Grey rocking isn't the problem, and it isn't the solution. It's the toll you pay to stay in a relationship that can't be fixed. And the question is whether the toll is affordable.
And affordability depends on what else you've got. If your life is rich with authentic relationships, the toll is affordable. If it isn't, the toll will bankrupt you.
That's the self-complexity point again, but framed as economics. And it makes the advice concrete. Don't just tolerate the gray rocking. Build the rest of the life.
Which brings us to the practical tips. And I want to be careful here because the tips should feel like they emerge from the research, not like a listicle. But I think there are five that are actually grounded.
Go!
1. Schedule openness. Deliberately plan time with people who get the full you, especially after gray rocking interactions. Don't wait to feel like yourself. Engineer the reset. 2. Use self-compassion breaks. After a gray rock interaction, take a few minutes to name what happened. I just had to be someone I'm not for 2 hours, and that was hard, and I'm going to be kind to myself about it. This metabolizes the cost consciously instead of letting it leak. 3. Check for bleed. Notice if you're being guarded with people who haven't earned it. Ask yourself, am I annoyed with my partner, or am I carrying residue from the gray rock interaction? Naming the distinction breaks the spell. 4. Set a time limit. Gray rocking isn't a forever strategy. If you can't see an endpoint, that's a signal to revisit no contact. Not because gray rocking is wrong, because it's not designed for permanent use. 5. Build self-complexity. Invest in roles and relationships that have nothing to do with the toxic person. The more substantial your other selves are, the less power the gray rock self has over you.
And I'd add a 6th, which is the costume ritual. Deliberately mark the transition into and out of the gray rock performance. The drive home where you tell yourself the costume is off. The song that reconnects you to yourself. Something that tells your brain the performance is over.
That's the role framing in action. It's not just a metaphor, it's a practice.
The answer to Daniel's question is yes. The duality is unnatural and uncomfortable. And the science says that's because it's costly. But the cost can be managed if you build the counterweight.
If you can't build the counterweight, that's information too. It might mean the relationship is too costly to maintain. And that's not a failure. That's a realistic appraisal.
I think that's the part that doesn't get said enough. Choosing no contact isn't giving up. It's recognizing that the toll exceeds what you can afford.
Choosing gray rocking isn't weakness. It's recognizing that some relationships can't be ended cleanly and you need a way to survive them.
I did that job once. The gray rocking, I mean. Paid to do it. There was a call center in Hartford, late 70s, that wanted to test whether their reps would escalate or give up when a customer was completely flat. No anger, no engagement, no hooks. Just a person giving one-word answers and long silences. They hired me to be the difficult customer. The boring, difficult customer. I lasted 6 weeks. It was the most exhausting job I ever had, because of the holding. Holding yourself flat for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. By Friday, I couldn't remember what I actually thought about anything. I'd go home and my wife would ask what I wanted for dinner and I'd say, I don't know, what do you want? Not because I didn't care. Because I'd forgotten how to have a preference. The thing is, I got better at it. The holding. After the first 2 weeks, it stopped feeling like drowning and started feeling like wearing a coat. A heavy coat. You put it on before the call, you take it off after. And the trick was the putting on and taking off. The wearing was just endurance. The putting on and taking off was the skill. I think you two are overcomplicating it. It's acting, that's all. And actors don't lose themselves in every role. They learn to enter and exit. The exit is the part people skip. They think if they just grit their teeth through the gray rocking, they'll bounce back automatically. They won't. You have to practice the exit. I had a hat. A gray fedora I bought at a thrift store in Hartford for $2. I'd put it on before the calls and take it off after. And I still have it. I wear it sometimes when I have to deal with my ex-wife's new husband. Same principle. Hat on, flat voice, one-word answers. Hat off, I'm me again.
You've been using a literal gray hat to gray rock for 30 years.
It works.
The hat is the ritual. That's exactly what I was describing with the costume transition. He externalized it, made it physical.
The hat's just a thing. The point is the boundary. You need a line between the performance and the rest of you. Most people don't have one. They just sort of blur into the gray rock and then wonder why they feel dead afterward.
The exit is the skill. That's the part I think most guides miss. They tell you how to enter the gray rock state. They never tell you how to leave it.
The leaving is where the bleed happens. If you don't mark the exit, the guardedness just continues. That's the Monday morning with the partner.
It's like getting out of a cold pool. You can't just stand up and expect to be warm. You have to dry off. The hat coming off was the drying off. For me, anyway.
The advice is, build yourself a hat.
Build yourself a something. A song, a drive, a phrase. Something that tells your brain the performance is over. Otherwise, the performance never ends.
That's the fear Daniel named, that the regression won't be bounded. Hilbert's saying the boundary is a practice. You have to build it and maintain it.
The other thing I learned is that the gray rock works better when you're not actually in it, when you're just doing it. When I first started, I was trying to be gray, and that was exhausting. By week 3, I was just doing the job. The gray was the job. I wasn't in it. I was performing it. And that made it easier to leave.
That's the role framing again. Not, I'm a guarded person. I'm a person who's currently performing guardedness.
Right. And the performance has a costume change. Hat on, hat off. That's the whole thing.
I think there's something important in what he's saying about practice. The first time you gray rock, it's going to feel wrong and scary and exhausting. But if you have to do it repeatedly, it becomes a skill. And skills are easier to bound than emotional states.
The first week I thought I was going to lose my mind. By week 6, I was bored. Not because it stopped being hard, because I'd gotten good at the entering and exiting. The middle was still work, but the edges were clean.
The answer to Daniel's question is, the duality doesn't stop being unnatural. You just get better at holding it. And the getting better is mostly about the transitions, not the holding.
That's what I said. You two just took longer to get there.
The hat is a good detail, though. A literal gray hat. It's almost two on the nose.
It was $2. It's a good hat.
You've been using it for 30 years. That's a good return on investment.
Best $2 I ever spent.
The practical version of this is, if you're going to gray rock, build the exit ritual before you need it. Don't wait until you're already in the gray state and then try to figure out how to get out. Have the song, the drive, the phrase ready. The hat, if you want to be literal about it.
Jet for bleed on the other side. Notice if the guardedness followed you home. And if it did, name it. That's the self-compassion piece. Just noticing and course correcting.
The research on self-compassion suggests that the naming itself is protective. When you can say, I'm being guarded because I just spent 3 hours gray rocking, not because I'm actually closed off or broken, that reframe changes how the brain processes the experience.
It moves it from a global statement about who you're to a specific statement about what you just did. And that's the whole game, isn't it? Keeping the gray rock a thing you do, not a thing you are.
That's the entire game. And it's a game you can win by making the cost something you can carry.
I keep thinking about the fact that the people who are best at gray rocking are often the ones who are forced to learn it. Forced. And that's a different kind of expertise. It's not a skill you're proud of. It's a scar that became useful.
That's why the regression fear is so sharp for people who've healed. Because they remember what it was like to be guarded all the time, they remember the flatness. And gray rocking feels like going back there, even if it's just for one afternoon.
The difference is that now they have a self to come back to. The healing gave them that. And the task is to protect the self while using the old survival skill, not to become the old self again.
That's the reframe that might actually help. Gray rocking isn't regression. It's a temporary deployment of an old skill in service of protecting the new self. The new self is the one who chooses to gray rock. The old self didn't have a choice.
The new self knows the exit. The old self didn't know there was an exit.
That's the difference between being trapped and being strategic. Daniel isn't trapped, he's choosing. And the choosing matters even when the choice is painful.
The open question I'm left with is whether gray rocking is ever a long-term solution, or whether it's always a bridge to something else. And I think the answer is, it's always a bridge. The only question is whether the bridge has an end.
The second question is, what happens when gray rocking becomes the default, not just for individuals, but culturally? As more people talk about narcissistic abuse and gray rocking, there's a risk. It becomes the first tool people reach for, rather than the last resort. And the self-silencing research suggests that's a problem.
Because the cost doesn't go away just because you've named the technique. You're still suppressing yourself. You're still paying the toll.
If you're paying the toll in every relationship, not just the toxic one, you're not protecting yourself. You're disappearing.
That's the thing I want to leave people with. Gray rocking is a tool for surviving specific relationships. It's not a way of being in the world. And the danger is when the tool becomes the identity.
Thanks to Hilbert Flemingtop for producing and for the hat revelation.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you're enjoying the show, leave a review. It helps other people find it.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.